Chapter 54. Old Soldier resignedly, that, of course, he gave up altogether when he first went out. Apostrophe apostrophe, does he say all this? Apostrophe apostrophe asked Mr. Wickfield. Say? My dear sir, apostrophe returned Mrs. Markleham, shaking her head and her fan, you little know my poor Jack Maldon, when you ask that question. Say? Not he. You might drag him at the heels of four wild horses first. Apostrophe, mama. Apostrophe apostrophe said Mrs. Strong. Annie, my dear, apostrophe returned her mother, once for all, I must really beg that you will not interfere with me, unless it is to confirm what I say. You know as well as I do that your cousin Maldon would be dragged at the heels of any number of wild horses. Why should I confine myself to four? I won't confine myself to 4, 8, 16, 2, and 30, rather than say anything calculated to overturn the doctor's plans. Apostrophe, Wickfield's plans, apostrophe said the doctor, stroking his face, and looking penitently at his advisor. That is to say, our joint plans for him. I said myself, a brother at home. Apostrophe, and I said added Mr. Wickfield gravely, abroad. I was the means of sending him abroad. It's my responsibility. Apostrophe, oh. Responsibility. Apostrophe said the old soldier. Everything was done for the best, my dear Mr. Wickfield. Everything was done for the kindest and best, we know. But if the dear fellow can't live there, he can't live there. And if he can't live there, he'll die there, sooner than he'll overturn the doctor's plans. I know him, apostrophe said the old soldier, fanning herself, in a sort of calm prophetic agony, and I know he'll die there, sooner than he'll overturn the doctor's plans. Apostrophe, well, well, ma'am, apostrophe said the doctor cheerfully, I am not bigoted to my plans, and I can overturn them myself. I can substitute some other plans. If Mr. Jack Maldon comes home on account of ill health, he must not be allowed to go back, and we must endeavor to make some more suitable and fortunate provision for him in this country. Apostrophe, Mrs. Markleham was so overcome by this generous speech which, I need not say, she had not at all expected or led up to, that she could only tell the doctor it was like himself, and go several times through that operation of kissing the sticks of her fan, and then tapping his hand with it. After which she gently chid her daughter Annie, for not being more demonstrative, when such kindnesses were showered, for her sake, on her old playfellow, and entertained us with some particulars concerning other deserving members of her family, whom it was desirable to set on their deserving legs. All this time, her daughter Annie never once spoke, or lifted up her eyes. All this time, Mr. Wickfield had his glance upon her as she sat by his own daughter's side. It appeared to me that he never thought of being observed by anyone, but was so intent upon her, and upon his own thoughts in connection with her, as to be quite absorbed. He now asked what Mr. Jack Maldon had actually written in reference to himself, and to whom he had written. Why, here, apostrophe said Mrs. Markleham, taking a letter from the chimney piece above the doctor's head, the dear fellow says to the doctor himself, where is it? Oh, I am sorry to inform you that my health is suffering severely, and that I fear I may be reduced to the necessity of returning home for a time, as the only hope of restoration. That's pretty plain, poor fellow. His only hope of restoration. But Annie's letter is plainer still. Annie, show me that letter again. Apostrophe, not now, mama, apostrophe she pleaded in a low tone. My dear, you absolutely are, on some subjects, one of the most ridiculous persons in the world, apostrophe returned her mother, and perhaps the most unnatural to the claims of your own family. We never should have heard of the letter at all, I believe, unless I had asked for it myself. Do you call that confidence, my love, towards Dr. Strong? I am surprised. You ought to know better. Apostrophe, the letter was reluctantly produced, and as I handed it to the old lady, I saw how the unwilling hand from which I took it, trembled. Now let us see, apostrophe said Mrs. Markleham, putting her glass to her eye, where the passage is. The remembrance of old times, my dearest Annie, and so forth, it's not there. The amiable old proctor, who's he? Dear me, Annie, how illegibly your cousin Maldon writes, and how stupid I am. Doctor, of course. Ah, amiable indeed. Apostrophe, apostrophe, here she left off, to kiss her fan again, and shake it at the doctor, who was looking at us in a state of placid satisfaction. Now I have found it. You may not be surprised to hear, Annie, no, to be sure, knowing that he never was really strong, what did I say just now? That I have undergone so much in this distant place, as to have decided to leave it at all hazards, on sick leave, if I can, on total resignation, if that is not to be obtained. What I have endured, and do endure here, is insupportable. And but for the promptitude of that best of creatures, apostrophe said Mrs. Markleham, telegraphing the doctor as before, and refolding the letter, it would be insupportable to me to think of. Apostrophe, Mr. Wickfield said not one word, though the old lady looked to him, as if for his commentary on this intelligence, but sat severely silent, with his eyes fixed on the ground. Long after the subject was dismissed, and other topics occupied us, he remained so, seldom raising his eyes, unless to rest them for a moment, with a thoughtful frown, upon the doctor, or his wife, or both. The doctor was very fond of music. Agnes sang with great sweetness and expression, and so did Mrs. Strong. They sang together, and played duets together, and we had quite a little concert. But I remarked two things. First, that though Annie soon recovered her composure, and was quite herself, there was a blank between her and Mr. Wickfield which separated them wholly from each other. Secondly, that Mr. Wickfield seemed to dislike the intimacy between her and Agnes, and to watch it with uneasiness. And now, I must confess, the recollection of what I had seen on that night, when Mr. Maldon went away, first began to return upon me with a meaning it had never had, and to trouble me. The innocent beauty of her face was not as innocent to me as it had been. I mistrusted the natural grace and charm of her manner, and when I looked at Agnes by her side, and thought how good and true Agnes was, suspicions arose within me that it was an ill-assorted friendship. She was so happy in it herself, however, and the other was so happy too, that they made the evening fly away, as if it were but an hour. It closed in an incident which I well remember. They were taking leave of each other, and Agnes was going to embrace her and kiss her, when Mr. Wickfield stepped between them, as if by accident, and drew Agnes quickly away. Then I saw, as though all the intervening time had been cancelled, and I were still standing in the doorway on the night of the departure, the expression of that night in the face of Mrs. Strong, as it confronted his. I cannot say what an impression this made upon me, or how impossible I found it, when I thought of her afterwards, to separate her from this look, and remember her face in its innocent loveliness again. It haunted me when I got home. I seemed to have left the doctor's roof with a dark cloud lowering on it. The reverence that I had for his gray head was mingled with commiseration for his faith in those who were treacherous to him, and with resentment against those who injured him. The impending shadow of a great affliction, and a great disgrace, that had no distinct form in it yet, fell like a stain upon the quiet place where I had worked and played as a boy, and did it a cruel wrong. I had no pleasure in thinking, any more, of the grave old broad-leaved aloe trees, which remained shut up in themselves 100 years together, and of the trim smooth grass plot, and the stone urns, and the doctor's walk, and the congenial sound of the cathedral bell hovering above them all. It was as if the tranquil sanctuary of my boyhood had been sacked before my face, and its peace and honor given to the winds. But morning brought with it my parting from the old house, which Agnes had filled with her influence, and that occupied my mind sufficiently. I should be there again soon, no doubt. I might sleep again perhaps often in my old room, But the days of my inhabiting there were gone, and the old time was past. I was heavier at heart when I packed up such of my books and clothes as still remained there to be sent to Dover than I cared to show to Uriah Heep, who was so officious to help me that I uncharitably thought him mighty glad that I was going. I got away from Agnes and her father, somehow, with an indifferent show of being very manly, and took my seat upon the box of the London coach. I was so softened and forgiving, going through the town, that I had half a mind to nod to my old enemy the butcher, and throw him 5 shillings to drink. But he looked such a very obdurate butcher as he stood scraping the great block in the shop, and moreover, his appearance was so little improved by the loss of a front tooth which I had knocked out, that I thought it best to make no advances. The main object on my mind, I remember, when we got fairly on the road, was to appear as old as possible to the coachman, and to speak extremely gruff. The latter point I achieved at great personal inconvenience. But I stuck to it, because I felt it was a grown-up sort of thing. You are going through, sir? ... said the coachman. Yes, William, I said, condescendingly. I knew him, I am going to London. I shall go down into Suffolk afterwards. ... sir? ... said the coachman. He knew as well as I did, that it was just as likely, at that time of year, I was going down there wailing, but I felt complimented too. I don't know, I said, pretending to be undecided, whether I shall take a shot or not. ... has got worry shy, I'm told, said William. So I understand, said one. Is Suffolk your county, sir? ... asked William. Yes, I said, with some importance. Suffolk's my county. I'm told the dumplings is uncommon fine down there, said William. I was not aware of it myself, but I felt it necessary to uphold the institutions of my county, and to evince a familiarity with them, so I shook my head, as much as to say, I believe you. ... and the punches, said William. There's cattle. A Suffolk punch, when he's a good un, is worth his weight in gold. Did you ever breed any Suffolk punches yourself, sir? ... I said, not exactly. Here's a gentleman behind me, I'll pound it, said William, as has bred 'em by wholesale. The gentleman spoken of was a gentleman with a very unpromising squint and a prominent chin, who had a tall white hat on with a narrow flat brim, and whose close-fitting drab trousers seemed to button all the way up outside his legs from his boots to his hips. His chin was cocked over the coachman's shoulder, so near to me that his breath quite tickled the back of my head. And as I looked at him, he leered at the leaders with the eye with which he didn't squint, in a very knowing manner. Ain't you? ... asked William. Ain't I what? ... said the gentleman behind. Bred them Suffolk punches by wholesale? I should think so, said the gentleman. There ain't no sort of horse that I ain't bred, and no sort of dorg. Horses and dorks is some men's fancy. They're whittles and drink to me lodging, wife, and children reading, writing, and arithmetic snuff, tobacker, and sleep. That ain't a sort of man to see sitting behind a coach box, is it though? Said William in my ear, as he handled the reins. I construed this remark into an indication of a wish that he should have my place, so I blushingly offered to resign it. Well, if you don't mind, sir, said William, I think it would be more correct. I have always considered this as the first fall I had in life. When I booked my place at the coach office, I had had box seat written against the entry, and had given the bookkeeper half a crown. I was got up in a special great coat and shawl, expressly to do honor to that distinguished eminence, had glorified myself upon it a good deal, and that felt that I was a credit to the coach. And here, in the very first stage, I was supplanted by a shabby man with a squint, who had no other merit than smelling like a livery stables, and being able to walk across me, more like a fly than a human being, while the horses were at a canter. A distrust of myself, which has often beset me in life on small occasions, when it would have been better away, was assuredly not stopped in its growth by this little incident outside the Canterbury coach. It was in vain to take refuge in gruffness of speech. I spoke from the pit of my stomach for the rest of the journey, but I felt completely extinguished, and dreadfully young. It was curious and interesting, nevertheless, to be sitting up there behind four horses, well educated, well dressed, and with plenty of money in my pocket, and to look out for the places where I had slept on my weary journey. I had abundant occupation for my thoughts, in every conspicuous landmark on the road. When I looked down at the trampers whom we passed, and saw that well-remembered style of face turned up, I felt as if the tinker's blackened hand were in the bosom of my shirt again. When we clattered through the narrow street of Chatham, and I caught a glimpse, in passing, of the lane where the old monster lived who had bought my jacket, I stretched my neck eagerly, to look for the place where I had sat, in the sun and in the shade, waiting for my money. When we came, at last, within a stage of London, and past the veritable Salem House, where Mr. Creakle had laid about him with a heavy hand, I would have given all I had for lawful permission to get down and thrash him, and let all the boys out like so many caged sparrows. We went to the Golden Cross at Charing Cross, then a mouldy sort of establishment in a close neighborhood. A waiter showed me into the coffee room, and a chambermaid introduced me to my small bedchamber, which smelt like a hackney coach, and was shut up like a family vault. I was still painfully conscious of my youth, for nobody stood in any awe of me at all. The chambermaid being utterly indifferent to my opinions on any subject, and the waiter being familiar with me, and offering advice to my inexperience. "Well now," said the waiter, in a tone of confidence, "what would you like for dinner? Young gentleman likes poultry in general. Have a fowl." I told him, as majestically as I could, that I wasn't in the humor for a fowl. "Ain't you?" said the waiter. "Young gentleman is generally tired of beef and mutton. Have a weal cutlet." I assented to this proposal, in default of being able to suggest. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.